Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The NFL and the Players Union are investigating allegations of so-called bounty hunting in pro football. Ahead in Only a Game, a former Pro Bowl linebacker weighs in on the practice. Also, after 14 years, Peyton Manning bolts the Colts, and a conversation with Robert Andrew Powell about his new book, This Love is Not for Cowards, Salvation and Soccer in Ciudad Juarez. Also ahead, hockey collides with history in the annual Battle of the Little Big Puck.
A couple of cowboys and a couple of members of the Nick and Eat band met in the old commercial hotel over a cold beer. And pretty soon it came down to, well, I'll tell you what, we can darn sure beat you guys in hockey.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. A week ago, the National Football League announced that for the past three seasons, more than 20 defensive players on the New Orleans Saints had participated in a system that paid players for knocking designated opponents from the game. The so-called bounty program was administered by Greg Williams, who was the defensive coordinator for the Saints. Williams has acknowledged that the program was, quote, a terrible mistake. On Monday, Commissioner Goodell will meet with Greg Williams. Certainly he will want to know about the locker room culture in the cities where Williams previously coached. Were the Titans paid bounties when he was their defensive coordinator during the late 90s? Retired defensive end Josh Evans said this week that they were. George Henshaw was the team's offensive coordinator at the time.
There was none of that at the Tennessee Titans. I'd never been aware of anything like that, and I would be totally shocked if it went on, and which I know did not.
How about in Buffalo, where Williams was the head coach from 2001 through 2003? Retired safety Coy Wire said this week that a small group of players there, quote, rewarded each other with a pay-for-play pool that took things too far. Izell Reese was a defensive back with the Bills during Williams' last season there.
No, I wasn't aware of it at all. And being a part of the defense, I would think I would have known. There was no bounty system or anything in place to my knowledge while being a part of defense in Buffalo.
The no's regarding intent to injure notwithstanding, Henshaw and Reese acknowledge players were paid for big hits. Both men now work with young athletes looking for schools where they can enhance their athletic opportunities. According to Izell Reese, they emphasize sportsmanship. But Reese says that if one of the football players he's mentoring makes it to the NFL, he won't be telling a coach and 20-odd players involved in a bounty-paying scheme that it's wrong.
It was yes, sir, no, sir, what do I got to do, what do you want me to do? You know, I've made it. This is all I know in the NFL. I don't know right from wrong, and I'm trying to make a name for myself. So whatever the coach asks you to do, you just follow suit. You just do what you're told. That's the mentality that goes with being a rookie. You just do what you're told regardless of what it is.
Joining me now to discuss the NFL bounty issue from the point of view of an NFL player and college coach is Steve Nelson, who was a linebacker with the New England Patriots from 1974 through 1987. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Bill.
When you were playing in the NFL, were you aware of players being rewarded for hits that knocked opponents off the field?
No, I was never on a team that offered any type of, you know, money to knock a guy out. You know, but when you're playing, I remember one instance, Bill, when I was in college, and we were playing a team, which is a very good team, and they had a great quarterback. And the defense coordinator kept talking about this guy and how good he was. And finally I said, Coach, you know, don't worry, I'm going to knock him out in the first quarter. And I happened to do it. You know, as a defensive player, you understand when the best offensive players aren't on the field, you have a better chance of winning. So, you know, if it's before the whistle blows and it's a legal hit, you know, that's part of the game. But to answer your question, Bill, I was never on a team or in a meeting which any of that stuff was ever brought up.
It sounds as if a bounty system might almost have been superfluous. Were you surprised to learn that there was a specific system in place where Saints players got bonuses if they injured opponents seriously enough so they had to leave the game?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised, to tell you the truth. The livelihood of all the players is important, and especially today and this day and age of pro football where, you know, so much of the player's safety is being scrutinized. So the head coach must have known about it. I mean, I can't believe they're that much into the dark that they didn't know what was going on. And to have that for different teams, and it just kind of blows my mind. You know, I don't think anyone can rationalize or justify their actions as being part of the game. So, very surprising.
Of course, you were a very successful college coach after you left the NFL. What would you have done if you'd overheard some of the defensive players on the college team you were coaching talking about maybe money changing hands to the benefit of somebody knocking out a player on the other team?
Oh, it wouldn't happen. You know, it'd be the end of it, you know, especially in Division, you know, III football, which I've coached in. And this doesn't matter what, you know, if you're in Pop Warner High School, Division III, or the NFL, it's just wrong to target and to actively try to hurt players.
Steve Nelson is a 3-time NFL Pro Bowler who spent 14 seasons with the New England Patriots. Later, he was the head coach and athletic director at Curry College. Steve, thanks very much for speaking with me.
No problem, Bill.
Paying bounties for hits that knock NFL players out of games raises issues that extend beyond the field of play. There are ethical concerns and even potential legal implications. Joining me now is the director of the Sports Law Institute at Vermont Law School and Sports Illustrated legal analyst Michael McCann. Michael, nice to have you with us again.
Nice to talk to you as well, Bill.
Also joining me is ESPN's NFL business analyst Andrew Brandt. He's also the president of the National Football Post. Brandt is a former team vice president of the Green Bay Packers and has worked as a sports agent. Andrew, welcome to Only a Game.
Good to be with you, Bill.
Let's start with you, Andrew, and your personal experience. Were you aware of bounty programs in the NFL when you were representing players?
I was not, nor was I, you know, carrying it forward. I was not aware of that even in my 9.5 years with the Green Bay Packers. You know, we heard sort of suggestions that might be out there, but it was hard to know if any of that was true or just kind of idle chatter. I will tell you one quick experience. It was 2007. We were playing the Vikings, and Adrian Peterson had just had this massive 200-yard performance, I believe, the week before. And I'm getting ready to go to the game, and I hear an ESPN report that, hey, the Packers' defensive backs are offering the defensive linemen DVDs from Best Buy if they hold Adrian Peterson under 100 yards today. And I kind of getting ready to go to the game. I'm like, you know, that doesn't sound great. And then, wouldn't you know it, alas, Adrian Peterson breaks his leg in that game. Clean hit, nothing dirty, but he broke his leg. So certainly the next morning, I was on the phone with the NFL, and it was just an inquiry as to what about these Best Buy things, and then the word bounty came up. And I was like, oh, my God, bounty? We're talking about DVDs from Best Buy. But regardless, it was shown to me at that point how serious an issue it is and was. And now, you know, this 3 years of overwhelming mountain of evidence proof that they have will take this to another level.
It's not exactly breaking news that NFL teams try to intimidate and hurt players with big hits. What's different when there's a relatively small amount of money attached to those hits?
I think the issue is when you bring money, and maybe any amount of money into it, that immediate gratification of getting that money will spur players to do something that potentially could injure if that is the goal. We all know you're supposed to hit as hard as you can, but when that has an intent to injure, that's the problem.
Well, tell me more, Michael, about the legal implications of paying players for devastating hits. What are some of the possible scenarios there?
Well, one scenario, which I don't think is likely to materialize, would be criminal charges, and specifically battery, where you hit somebody else without that person's permission. Obviously, an NFL player gives permission by playing in the game that he's going to get tackled, and he's going to get tackled hard by large guys who are running really fast. He assumes that risk. He doesn't assume, though, that he's going to have somebody trying to take out his knees. There's conspiracy. Conspiracy refers to a group of people getting together to orchestrate a crime, here being battery. And the group of people would presumably be the coach, Greg Williams, the defensive coordinator, and others who knew about it and facilitated it. But I should note, courts seldom get involved with sports disputes, and that's particularly true in the United States. Other potential legal follow-up from this bounty situation would be personal injury lawsuits. And lastly, I would say a couple of small points would be tax evasion. Did these players get a benefit in the form of $10,000 or even $1,000 that they didn't pay taxes on?
You know, Bill, if I could follow up related to that in terms of money, in the NFL, as your listeners may know, there's a cap that really limits what teams can pay players, and everything has to be cash. I mean, everything has to be as per the contract, that's what you pay them. If you go outside of the contract, that's cap circumvention, that's cap cheating, and that will be disciplined.
Michael, hundreds of retired players are already suing the NFL, claiming the league hid information about the long-term effects of concussions and failed to protect them from permanent injury. What is the significance of these bounty programs in regard to the lawsuits?
The likely significance is that lawyers in these lawsuits will use evidence of the bounty program to show that the league is not safe, that the league isn't thinking about safety. Now, the league could, of course, say that really apples and oranges when you're looking at concussions versus the bounty program. But lawyers who are filing these lawsuits, I'm sure, will amend their complaints to include information on the bounty program.
Andrew, Greg Williams' bounty program may not have been limited to the Saints. He may have run similar systems with Buffalo, Tennessee, and Washington, where he previously worked. He's now employed by St. Louis, and he will be meeting with NFL officials on Monday. What do you expect his punishment to be?
My sense is it's not out of the question that he has the year off, meaning that he would be suspended the entire season. He has a multi-year contract with the Rams that won't be affected beyond this year, but he will be prohibited from coaching the Rams at least, I think, half the season.
What about punishments beyond Greg Williams?
There are people involved here that are going to get serious punishment, and that would include the head coach of the Saints. That's Sean Payton. Is he implicit in it, in direct involvement in paying bounties? Not sure, but it was certainly an institutional problem, and he's the head coach. Beyond that, the management, general manager Mickey Loomis, will feel the pain of this. He will have some sort of suspension. So it's an institutional punishment. The Saints do not have a number one draft pick in 2012, but I would expect there would be either going after their second round pick in this year or their first round pick in 2013.
A big part of the NFL brand, as you guys have suggested, is tough players delivering big hits. Everybody expects that. For all the criticism of bounties the past week or so, I wonder if this might, curiously enough, enhance the league's image with some fans, tough guys being paid to be even tougher.
Even if, let's say, there is an increase in fan interest among some fans because they think that bounties are going on, sort of like almost like a different sport, I don't think whatever value that is to the NFL outweighs the loss of reputation that the league has when there are a lot of fans who are going to say, you know, what am I watching? Am I watching competitive football or am I watching a hitman show?
Michael McCann is the director of the Sports Law Institute at Vermont Law School, and he's a legal analyst for Sports Illustrated as well. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
And Andrew Brand is ESPN's NFL business analyst and the president of the National Football Post. Andrew, thanks for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The headline was delightful for the hockey fans, of course, or fans of any animal, a wombat or a horse. The optimistic Penguins clear Sid Crosby to return, though pessimistic elephants might feel that they should learn that hammered heads and optimism scarcely pair up well. A halfway thoughtful octopus could reasonably tell the optimistic Penguins to be wary of that stance. Level-headed Labrador might also look askance at Penguins optimistic about their leader coming back. And ducks inclined toward skepticism doubtfully would quack. But unicorns will blow their horns as loudly they agree that optimistic penguins are a lovely thing to see. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, Brave Soccer in Ciudad Juarez. But first, Peyton Manning is no longer a Colt.
I've been a Colt for almost all of my adult life. But I guess in life and in sports, we all know that nothing lasts forever. Times change, circumstances change, and that's the reality of playing in the NFL.
On Wednesday, the Indianapolis Colts severed ties with the man who had been the face of the franchise for 14 seasons. Here to discuss what Manning has meant to Colts fans is Greg Doyle of CBS Sports. Greg, you've covered games in Indianapolis. What are some of your favorite memories of Peyton Manning with the Colts?
Oh, just the way he walks out on that field, and you can see 21 sets of eyes on him. It's a special thing that he has and Tom Brady has that when he steps out there, that's not just a guy on the field. That's people recognize this is an all-time great. And I'm talking about people on both sidelines, both sides of the field. It's pretty awe-inspiring just to watch how much respect he has just by walking to the huddle.
Do you have a sense of what fans around the country are saying about Manning's departure?
Yeah, they're all saying, come play for my team. They all want him. I mean, if you go on the internet and do a Google search with Peyton Manning and then every individual team out there, you will find stories, message boards, something begging, pleading for this guy to come play for us. With the exception of New England and, you know, Green Bay, maybe a few others, everybody wants Peyton Manning right now.
If the Colts had decided to retain Manning, it would have cost the team a $28 million signing bonus. That was one large stumbling block, to be sure, but perhaps not the only one?
I think if Andrew Luck doesn't exist, the Colts go ahead and write that check for $28 million and hope for the best. But Andrew Luck, the Colts felt, was one of these once-in-a-lifetime, at least once-in-a-generation type quarterbacks. That is what the hype about him says. He's got to go out and prove it, but if Andrew Luck is what NFL scouts say he is, then the Colts had no choice but to get rid of Peyton because Andrew Luck is apparently going to be just about as good.
What a lot of pressure is on that young man when the next NFL season begins.
Yeah, can you imagine that? I mean, yes, it's not just you're the number one overall pick on a team that won two or three games last year, which is enough pressure, but you're the reason this team got rid of their icon because they think you're going to be that good too. That's a big mouthful.
The Colts, of course, were horrible last year. That's why they have the first pick. What does the team have to do to get back towards championship form?
Well, they've got to start from scratch. They have nothing anywhere. Everybody good is a free agent. Everybody bad is on their team. They're all banged up. They really seriously have holes everywhere. It's not like, well, if they could just get another receiver or just shore up their offensive line. No, they've got problems everywhere. And on defense, too. The Colts were a great, great team about three, 4 years ago. And all of those guys got old overnight, and Peyton got hurt. And Andrew Luck is not coming into a situation that Manning came into 14 years ago. And the Colts have acknowledged that they do not have the pieces around him now that Peyton had back then. So what they have to do is, I don't know, it's going to take a lot of patience because this team will not be all that good for the next two or three years. It's just not going to happen.
Manning says he'll play for another team next season. Will Colts fans be as vindictive about that as, say, Clevelanders were about LeBron James' departure from the Cavaliers?
Not even close. I think you're going to see a lot of people, a lot of Colts fans will adopt Peyton's team as their second favorite team. And what'll be interesting is when the Colts play Peyton's team, whoever that is. I think you'll see a really conflicted stadium whenever Peyton completes a pass. It's going to be really interesting, the volume, because they love him. And he didn't leave badly. In fact, he didn't even want to leave. He wanted to stay. LeBron left and left badly. Mm. Peyton wanted to stay and just managed to find a classy way to be told, go away.
When quarterbacks change teams toward the ends of their careers, sometimes it goes okay. Brett Favre did okay, and I remember Y.A. Tittle did all right when he changed teams late in his career, but often it doesn't go so well. What's your prognosis for Manning as a non-Colt?
It's not going to go so well. I just hope he ends up upright. I'm afraid for that neck. It just makes me leery. But for me, a success for Peyton Manning would be that he can walk when he's all said and done. For him, a success would be a Super Bowl ring. He's not going to come back and start over anywhere else without a Super Bowl ring being in mind. And I just don't see how that's going to happen. Anybody out there that needs a quarterback is probably in bad enough shape. They're not that close to winning at all, especially with a guy 36 years old who hadn't played in a year and isn't mobile to begin with and might get hurt. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me, really. He's going to come back and do what everybody else ever did, except for Y.A. Tittle. Nice reference. He's going to have the same problems everybody does when they're an old switching teams quarterback.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist with CBSSports.com. Greg, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
This week's NCAA basketball conference tournaments will wind down today and tomorrow, setting the stage for Selection Sunday, during which 68 teams hope for high seedings and favorable matchups. This is particularly true for the so-called mid-major teams, which face more obstacles to capture at-large bids than the schools from the power conferences. When mid-majors are bypassed on at-large berths, the price is steep. Only a Game's Greg Eklund has the story.
When I asked Wichita State coach Greg Marshall last year about playing in a mid-major conference, it struck a nerve.
Are we mid-major?
The general.
Are we mid-major?
I told him that the Missouri Valley Conference is regarded as a mid-major conference.
Is it? Well, check my bank account, check my W-2, check our budget, check the way we travel, check the crowd tomorrow, check my talent level in my program, and tell me it's mid-major.
Marshall prefers the term non-BCS over mid-major. Keep in mind that he was miffed last year at the Shockers' exclusion from the NCAA tournament.
The fallacy that you have to be in a BCS league and they deserve 11 bids and all this stuff is ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
The Shockers won the National Invitation Tournament last year. With the regular season's best conference record of 16-2 tucked away this year, they're certain to make the NCAA tournament. Wichita State is 27-5 overall and ranked 16th in this week's AP poll. The Valley's automatic bid went to the conference tournament winner, Creighton, so the league will likely have two teams in the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2007. Under coach Greg McDermott, Creighton took the necessary path for mid-majors to make an impression, winning away from its home court.
We've had a target on our back since our win at San Diego State when we first entered the rankings, and there aren't many schools like ours in a mid-major conference that are essentially ranked the entire season.
That was in late November when the Blue Jays won at San Diego State. Now Creighton, ranked 19th in the AP poll with a 28-5 record, is one spot behind the 18th-ranked Aztecs. 14 of Creighton's wins were away from the CenturyLink Center in downtown Omaha. Adding a large number of road games isn't something mid-majors like to do, but it's the only way to build schedule strength for the NCAA selection committee to consider. So, fewer teams from BCS conferences travel to the home arenas of mid-majors. In December, when Missouri State played host to Oklahoma State, it was the first time in 10 years a Big 12 team played in Springfield, Missouri.
Scheduling is difficult to begin with.
Alan Ward, the athletics director at 11th-ranked Murray State in Kentucky, knows the price a mid-major has to pay for 25 straight winning seasons.
When you have a lot of success like Murray State has, and you try to schedule games that are home and home, where you try to have some home games so you can build your season ticket package, it's difficult to have ones that you'd want, you know, regional, those that are attractive to your fan base, come to Murray. So, yeah, we fight that each and every year.
That fight has become part of the routine for mid-majors, according to Luke Wynn, a college basketball writer for Sports Illustrated.
Scheduling in college basketball is not fair right now for mid-majors, but the smarter teams are understanding what they need to do. They need to take some risks in the early season, you know, and they can pay off later on.
The payoff is getting into the 68-team field in order to obtain a slice of the tournament's television revenue. This is the second year of the NCAA's 14-year, $10.8 billion contract with CBS and Turner Broadcasting. It's the job of Missouri Valley Conference Commissioner Doug Elgin to know how that money is distributed.
For every game your conference plays in the 2012 NCAA tournament, it's going to be about $1.5 million, win or lose. But if you win, obviously you get another opportunity. So if you go to the second round, it's about $3 million. If you get into the Sweet 16 and lose in that round, it's about $4.5 million. It's paid out over the next 6 years in increasing installments.
When a team that believes it has the credentials is snubbed, it's necessary for the coach to console his players and answer to his athletics director. 6 years ago, Missouri State was ranked 21st in Ratings Percentage Index, or RPI, a factor the committee uses to measure the strength of schedule. The Bears had won 20 out of their 28 games, but with television cameras present, blank faces filled the room as the team saw the bracket filled without Missouri State. Retired athletics director Bill Rowe was there.
It cuts your heart out, and you ache for the team and the coaches, and yet right at that particular moment, it's heartbreaking. There's no other way to say it. That's what it's like.
Selection Sunday begins tomorrow at 6 p.m. Eastern on CBS. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund.
Of life in Juarez, Mexico, which many regarded as hopeless, Robert Andrew Powell writes, "Hope is all the Juarenses have. They overflow with hope. Hope is the ultimate coping mechanism." He's referring to both the city of Juarez itself and the soccer team that plays there, Los Indios. His book is This Love is Not for Cowards, Salvation and Soccer in Ciudad Juarez, and the author joins me from WLRN in Miami. Robert, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's good to be here, Bill.
You thought you knew what you were getting into before you moved to Juarez in 2009. Were you surprised by the level of violence when you actually arrived?
I was surprised. I guess I wasn't surprised in theory. I knew it was a very violent city, obviously. That's all I'd read about. I went to the city in part because they had a soccer team. And to me, having a soccer team was such a normal activity, which made me think that there was more to the city than just murder. And yet, to answer your question, there was a lot of murder. It was overwhelming.
Los Indios, the team which you write about in This Love Is Not for Cowards, had climbed up into the first division, the top level of pro soccer in Mexico. What impact did that success have on the city?
It can't be overstated. What a great thing it was for the city. As the owner of the team told me, it was the first time it's the only time in modern Juarez where you would hear the name Juarez on the news without the antecedent, you know, bloody or murderous. It was soccer. It was something normal, and it was something that the people of Juarez took tremendous pride in.
How hard was it for those running the team, Los Indios, to convince promising players that they should relocate to Juarez?
It was all but impossible. They had to get the most desperate players in that. The general manager I got to know very well, and he would tell me he would sign a player from a team in Guadalajara and say, "Look, you have a chance to be a starter here in the first division. You know, this is the professional opportunity of your lifetime." And the player would be like, "All right, great, I'm in." And then a day later, the player would call the general manager and like, "Look, I spoke to my wife and we're not coming." The wife makes a good point, and this happened over and over again. And the general manager ended up like scouting China and Spain and anywhere he could find where people hadn't heard really about Juarez.
Francisco Ibarra, the owner of Los Indios, appears to regard running the team almost as a public service or a social project. But then there are suspicions raised that the team was tied to La Línea, one of the major drug cartels, for which Ibarra may have been laundering money. Was that happening?
I end up concluding that he wasn't. But I can't rule out the construction company that his family owns. The DEA is accused the Indios of laundering drug money. One of the best arguments that the team itself, specifically the team, was not laundering drug money is that they were horrible. Like if they were,
it would have been
better
if they'd had the money coming in.
The team lost the entire time I was there. They ended up setting a Mexican record for longest winless streak in the major league. This was a bare-bones skeletal crew, and they couldn't pay their players, and they had the worst players in the league. And so it was hard to argue that the money was flowing into Los Indios.
There's an especially painful and powerful point in the book where you write about watching a game when a bomb goes off close by, and you write about the delayed impact of that event. Tell us a little about that incident and what it taught you about Juarez and about yourself.
The team had already been relegated to the minors, and sort of the main player that I cover in the team, an American named Marco Vidal, had been traded to a team called Pachuca. And I was watching the first Pachuca game of the season at a sports bar, and in the middle of the game, this car bomb goes off that kills four first responders. What amazed me is, because I've been there almost 9 months by that point, is how I didn't respond. Like, I watched the rest of the game. at the sports bar. I drank beer and I ate chicken wings. A week earlier, there'd been a man killed on my street, and the only thing that mattered to me is that all the police trucks were blocking me in and I couldn't get to the laundromat. Like, I just got numb. A good friend of mine in Juarez, he strongly encouraged me to leave, and he was convincing, and I left.
Have you followed the fortunes of Los Indios since you left Juarez and returned to the U.S.?
Last time I went to a game was in October of 2011, and they were in the minors, and they were doing horrible, and it was just obvious that this team was dying. Like, it was sad. It was sad to go to the stadium where there were only a couple hundred people, where it used to be packed with 35,000. Within the last 6 months, they folded all together. I don't know what to glom onto in Juarez that can give the sense of hope that the Indios did.
Well, finally, I want to focus on a conclusion you took away from your experience. You wrote, La Gente, the people, proved to be bigger than the cartels. What part did the team, the soccer team, play in your reaching that conclusion?
That statement I make there ties into a specific incident in that on the day the Indios qualified for the Primera, the Major League, was a day when the cartels had warned, don't go out, it's going to be the bloodiest weekend in the history of Juarez. Don't go to bars, don't go on Main Street, stay indoors. And when the Indios won, everyone spilled into the streets and had an all-night party. It was a beautiful moment. And I get cynical about sports sometimes, about the value that they can bring to a city. And it was inarguable in Juarez that this team was a beautiful thing in a city that doesn't have a lot of beauty.
Robert Andrew Powell is the author of This Love is Not for Cowards, Salvation in Soccer in Ciudad Juarez. The book is published by Bloomsbury, and the author joined me from WLRN in Miami. Robert, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.
Part of the fun of being a prince is that when you compete at something, your opponent lets you win. The UK's Prince Harry found that out on a visit to Jamaica this week when he jumped the gun in a 100-meter foot race with Olympic gold medalist Usain Bolt. And Bolt not only failed to protest, he called the prince cool and said it was an honor and a pleasure to meet him. Of course, Prince Harry never heard the compliment as he was 40 yards down the track celebrating his victory in what one newspaper called flamboyant style. Well, yeah, he's a prince, isn't he? A modest celebration would have been common. Royalty. That's what you are, you see. And that's what you'll always be. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Cowboys and Indians on Ice. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me from NPR's New York Bureau for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
It was not a good week for the men's basketball program at Auburn. On Thursday, Ole Miss knocked the Tigers out of the SEC tournament's first round. And on the same day, it was announced that federal authorities were investigating suspended Auburn guard Verez Ward for point shaving.
Yeah, this is it's the federal authorities thing that should really get people's attention, because this is not the NCAA anymore. These are the people who can throw you, who will not put you on suspension and make you miss bowl games or basketball tournaments. They will put you in the hoosegow.
Charlie, we've got Selection Sunday coming up tomorrow. You got any dream matchups that you're thinking about for the first round or any time?
Well, having watched my alma mater, the Marquette Warriors, fall in an incredibly meat-headed fashion to Louisville on Thursday night, I just assumed they not play anybody for a couple weeks. Can we do that? Can we arrange for them to have, like, a two-week bye in the tournament?
I think that's called a bye, and I think you have to earn it, and you don't earn it by playing like a meathead.
We certainly didn't do it the other night, even if they'd existed, which they don't. I'm going to be following with great interest my Murray State Racers, who I think have been taking a little bit of heat for having lost one entire game this year, and people don't seem to think they can do anything in the tournament. They will shake somebody up, I guarantee it. And, of course, Harvard against whoever.
Last week, the NFL revealed that it was investigating the New Orleans Saints, which the league says operated a bounty system to reward players who could knock designated opponents out of games. Greg Williams will meet with Commissioner Goodell on Monday to discuss that matter. What do you think will be the outcome?
I think Greg Williams is going to get suspended for 2 or 3 years. And I think the New Orleans Saints are going to get whacked much harder than the New England Patriots did for filming from the sidelines a few years back. This is a moral abyss that New Orleans has stumbled into. And they've stumbled into it at exactly the wrong time, is when the NFL has finally decided to pay attention to this nonsense.
Saints head coach Sean Payton was apparently aware of the program, as was the team's general manager, Mickey Loomis. How far up the chain do you suppose the penalties go in this?
Oh, I think you'll see Sean Payton lose some games. I don't know how you suspend a general manager. Maybe you can suspend him for making trades for a couple of years.
Indianapolis owner Jim Irsay elected not to pay the $28 million signing bonus that re-signing 14-year quarterback Peyton Manning would have cost the Colts. Has Mr. Irsay made a mistake?
No, I don't think so. I think this is a good decision. I think it will redound to Peyton Manning's credit wherever he ends up. There's a lot of talk down here that he's going to end up with the Jets next year. He wants to stay in the American Football Conference, which means the Jets or Kansas City or perhaps even Miami. I don't think the Ursays had any choice. They have a chance to draft a young quarterback. They have I mean, for all Peyton Manning has meant to that franchise, and he's meant everything to that franchise, he is a mid-30s quarterback with a history of neck injuries.
It's not unusual for an NBA coach to claim that referees are not doing enough to protect one of the stars from thugs and goons throughout the league, Charlie. But Timberwolves head coach Rick Adelman says that he has cinematic evidence that point guard Ricky Rubio is being mugged during games. What do you suppose he hopes to accomplish with his films?
I don't know. I think what he is going to accomplish is to get Ricky Rubio buffeted around even harder by the fellow players. This is like finking to the principal.
Chicago Cubs manager Theo Epstein distributed what has been described as a, quote, thick manual to his team. It's titled The Cubs Way, and it reportedly contains advice on how everybody should run the bases and get haircuts. He hasn't had much time to write The Cubs Way. It's got to just be the Red Sox way with a different color cover on it, right?
Well, first of all, there is the Cubs way and the Red Sox way, and there's Swan's way, which is an even thicker manual. I think he would be much better off, baseball pun coming, alert, alert, aruga, aruga. I think he would be a lot better off with a Charlie manual than any kind of a training manual. Thank you. I'll be working here for the rest of the week.
All right. It's spring training, and you are former Red Sox closer Jonathan Papelbon, now with the Phillies, and a reporter asks you whether Philadelphia fans are smarter than Boston fans. Do you say, A, that's a silly question, B, both towns are full of great fans, or C, hold on a second till I can get my foot all the way into my mouth?
Well, I'm not the guy who once danced a jig in my underwear on the mound with a beer box on my head. So I would probably answer B. But we know that Jonathan Papelbon, the newly minted closer of the Philadelphia Phillies, answered C, where he said he essentially called the Philadelphia fans a little smarter than the Red Sox fans, but did admit the Red Sox fans were, you know, a touch more hysterical.
Yes, hysteria did come into it. Jose Canseco, who had intended to resume his baseball career with Mexico's Quintana Roo Tigers, has been foiled. His prospective employer says he took a banned substance, that would be testosterone. Canseco says, quote, how can I test positive when I never took any test? This is the man who once boasted that what came out of his mouth amounted to fiery truth, so no reason to doubt him, right?
Well, no, he's just what's coming out of his mouth now is fiery illogic, which reminds me of nothing more than the line, how can you be in two places at once when you're not
when
anywhere
you're
at
not
all?
Anywhere at all.
How can you fail
Absolutely.
A test if you never take a test?
Charlie, the Pittsburgh Penguins have unveiled a 4,700-pound statue outside of their rink, and it's not a big statue of a penguin, is it?
No, it's a statue of Mario Lemieux, the most famous penguin of them all, short of those ones in the movie a couple of years ago that went walking across the Arctic.
For years, security around the Olympic Games has been getting tighter and tighter, but now, courtesy of the British Olympic Association, it may get tighter than ever. What do you make of their recommendation for athletes to not shake hands during the London Games this summer?
Well, my understanding of this is that it's not really a security thing, it's a health thing.
That's the idea. You might catch cold if you shake hands with somebody.
Yeah, but don't, like, the soccer teams, isn't there a ritual where they shake hands before the game?
I don't think it's just the soccer teams. I think there's a good deal of handshaking.
Well, there's a handshaking, I know for an experience, after every fencing bout, but they're wearing gloves, so I guess that's okay.
That's probably all right.
But, I mean, there's a lot of high-fiving at the end of the 100-yard dash and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how do you know that you're not going to catch, you know, a terrible skin disease from the flag they drape over you after you win?
And finally, Charlie, on Sunday, Erie Otters forward Connor Crisp was pressed into action as an emergency netminder. 17-year-old had not played goalie since he was 5, and he had to wear the other guy's ill-fitting goalie skates. He made 32 saves, and he was named the game's top star, and he lost 13-4.
Okay, let's be really fair to Connor, okay? If you make 32 saves and you're not really a goalie, you've done your job.
And your feet hurt the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. The problem with these 13 goals are pretty plainly the other Erie Otters who aren't very good at their jobs. Good for you, Connor. You're my number one star, too. Go out some night and hit all of your defensemen over the head with a sock.
You can find Charlie Pierce's sports writing at Grantland, among other places. And, of course, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Today marks the beginning of the 17th season of Major League Soccer, and sacre bleu, now the league includes a team in Montreal. May they fare better than baseball's late and not especially lamented Expos. On Wednesday afternoon, Leo Messi scored 5 times during a 7-1 pasting of Bayern Leverkusen in a match that ushered Barcelona into the quarterfinals of the Champions League competition. This had nothing whatsoever to do with Major League Soccer, but I thought you should know. It's kind of a shame that fans of the U.S. game won't get to see Leo Messi play in their league since he's happy in Barcelona, and no wonder. 5 goals in a Champions League game. Nobody's ever done that before. 5 NFL quarterbacks have thrown 7 touchdown passes in one game, and 15 Major League Baseball players have hit 4 home runs in one game, but nobody but Messi has scored 5 times in a Champions League game. But I digress. It is at least as customary as it is silly to make predictions at the beginning of any sports season. Regarding MLS, the smart money is on the Los Angeles Galaxy to repeat. The accomplished Bruce Arena is still running the show. David Beckham has foregone various European opportunities, real and imagined, to remain in Los Angeles, and Landon Donovan and Robbie Keane will continue to shine for the Galaxy. They also have reacquired Juninho, who comes from Brazil. Many Brazilians are very good at playing soccer. There are various ways to measure the progress of professional soccer in the U.S. On the one hand, so far, neither manifestation of women's pro soccer has been able to make it past year 3. But on the other hand, MLS has more games on TV, more built-for-soccer venues, and more distinct ownership groups than ever before. What MLS doesn't have is anybody likely to score 5 goals in a significant game, which is what Leo Messi did for Barcelona on Wednesday afternoon, just in case you weren't listening. I've neglected to mention any of the Eastern Conference MLS teams because the West appears much the stronger conference, but okay, Houston has some horses, though why a team in Texas is in the Eastern Division of anything resists explanation. Beyond that, one guy has simulated the entire season on FIFA Soccer 12, and he says the New York Red Bulls will win the East.
And they will.
Well, let's see how they do tomorrow in Dallas. More than 130 years ago, Sitting Bull arrived in Canada on the run after defeating Colonel George A. Custer at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. He stayed just 4 years, but his presence had a lasting impact on the people who live north of the border, both the ranchers and the Cree. A tribute to that colorful history plays out once a year at the hockey rink in Maple Creek, Saskatchewan, in a charity game known locally as the Battle of the Little Big Puck. Reporter Amy Jo Eamon attended this year's game, and she has our story.
Ladies and gentlemen, the friendship continues to the 30th annual Battle of the Little Big Pine.
The Cowboys and the Cree face off at center ice. Between them, as referee, is the local Mountie. The town folk of Maple Creek, population 2,200, have come out to watch.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, our staff sergeant, whistles to center ice. Third period, let's play hockey! Are you ready to rumble?
The Cowboys are all local ranchers who are, or have been, members of a rodeo association. The Cree are all members of the Nekanit First Nation, a reserve just south of town in the Cypress Hills. The Cowboys get off to a rough start. At the end of the second period, the score is 9-6 for the Cree.
Ladies and gentlemen, 10th goal of the game scored by number 4, Chief Jordy Fourhorns.
Joe Braniff has played for the Cowboys for 25 years. He recalls how this game of Cowboys versus Indians got its start.
The roots go back to a hot summer day in July where a couple of Cowboys and a couple of members of the Nekanit band met in the old commercial hotel over a cold beer. And as good friends do, they got bickering good-naturedly as to who could ride the rankest horses and rope the quickest. And pretty soon it came down to, well, I'll tell you what, we can darn sure beat you guys in hockey.
That friendly challenge has stayed friendly despite the potential pitfalls. Braniff says in 30 years, there's never been a fight.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a community anywhere in Canada where you could call it a cowboy-Indian game and not offend anybody, where you could put two cultures like that against each other in a hockey game, a fast-paced hockey game with bragging rights and everything else at stake, and not turn it into a war. Both sides are very proud of that.
Call of the goal, the big cowboy assisted by the little cowboy. 7th goal of the game for the Cowboys. We're in a 10-7 shootout.
Dale Mosquito plays for the Cree. He says this hockey game is a point of pride for the people of Nekanit, whose ancestors lived here long before the Cowboys arrived.
You know, we're proud of our heritage. We've coexisted with the town of Maple Creek, and for us that's tradition, the Battle of the Little Big Puck helps us celebrate that fact.
That relationship between Cree and Cowboy was shaped, in no small part, by another battle, the Battle of the Little Bighorn. After Colonel Custer's defeat in 1876, 5,000 Lakota and their leader Sitting Bull crossed the border into Canada and sought refuge southeast of present-day Maple Creek. Their arrival was peaceful, according to local historian Royce Pettyjohn, but strained relations between the two countries.
Essentially, you've got, from the Americans' perspective, an undefeated hostile force hovering on their northern border, and they were concerned with issues of, you know, they might term today homeland security. They were concerned about the Lakota raiding down into the United States and then coming back into the safety of Canada. And for Canada, of course, the presence of Sitting Bull and these refugees from war in the United States represented the potential wrench to be thrown into that nice, peaceful, orderly process of westward expansion.
4 years later, Sitting Bull returned to the United States, but Canadian authorities were taking no chances. They decided to move all the Cree away from the U.S. border to designated reserves far to the north. But one chief, Chief Nekanit, and his people refused to go. They lived freely, made friends with the settlers, worked on their farms, and learned to rodeo. Eventually, with help of sympathetic ranchers, Nekanit's descendants were granted their reserve in the Cypress Hills.
And I think that's part of the reason why today you can have an event like the Battle of the Little Big Puck, where you have, for the benefit of charity, essentially a game that pays tribute to that integrated past of, you know, essentially cowboys and Indians.
Back at the hockey rink, it's the third period, and both teams have switched from their hockey gear to more traditional outfits. They're dressed as cowboys and Indians. It's a colorful mix of chaps and cowboy hats, feathers, face paint, and beads. The Mountie has changed from the black and white referee jersey to his bright red coat and Stetson. Dale Mosquito, now dressed in moose hide, says he's proud to be a role model for a younger generation, such as his own son.
I said, you know, Dad is You know, I don't know how much longer I'll be able to lace up the skates, so I'm really excited that they're deciding and, you know, pursuing this this opportunity because, you know, I think they'll carry it long into the future.
Score of the hockey game, 15-10, if you were counting. Score of the friendships, how about your bat in 1,000?
For Only a Game, I'm Amy Jo Eman.
It's friendship, friendship, just a perfect friendship. When other friendships have been forgot, ours will still be hot.
A lot of dig, dig, dig.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. We had help this week from Peter Mayers at WLRN in Miami. Our intern is Jeremy Conlin. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. Our final word this week comes from former NFL safety Izel Reese, who was in a hurry this morning.
I had some Pop-Tarts, unfortunately. I'm still looking for a real breakfast.
Last week, it was former big league pitcher Dirk Hayhurst discussing his supper of spaghetti with octopus and cactus milkshake. This week, Pop-Tarts. And next week, I'm fasting. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
If you're ever in a mill and get sawed in half, I won't laugh. It's friendship, friendship, just a perfect blandship. When other friendships are up the creek, ours will still be slick.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.